Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the African American community. This week I'll have stories from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's 2026 Black History Month series of stories. I'll have readings about the Center for Disease Control, Walter White, one of the early leaders of the NAACP, and I'm starting with this. This year's Atlanta Journal-Constitution Black History Month series marks the 100th anniversary of the National Observance of Black History, and the 11th year, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has examined the role African Americans played in building Atlanta and shaping American culture. This story is an introduction to the series. It's titled, 5 Years That Changed Atlanta, Tracing the Dynamics of Race, Power, and Culture Through Events That Fundamentally Reshaped Our City. This was written by Ernie Suggs and was published February 1st, 2026. In 1929, at least for Black Atlantans, Atlanta sat at a crossroads. It was a place of opportunity, tightly fenced by segregation. Black residents built schools, businesses, churches, and neighborhoods, even as Jim Crow laws dictated where they could live, learn, work, and vote. Atlanta was, at once, one of the most promising Black cities in the country and one of the most rigidly controlled. The slogan, "The City Too Busy to Hate," had not yet entered the civic lexicon, but the logic behind it was already visible. White leaders favored economic order over racial terror. Not equality, but segregation instead of the mob violence seen elsewhere in the South. For Black Atlantans, that uneasy balance created narrow but vital space to build institutions of their own. That tension between possibility and constraint is central to understanding Black history, said Carsonia Wise Whitehead, president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. Black history is not just about struggle, Whitehead said. It's also about building, about agency, about achievement. Nowhere was that clearer than along Auburn Avenue. By 1929, the street, often described as the richest Negro street in America, was lined with Black-owned banks, insurance companies, and funeral homes. Sustaining a growing Black middle class of teachers, ministers, doctors, and entrepreneurs, rooted in stable neighborhoods and social networks. By the late 1920s, Atlanta had become the premier center of Black higher learning, anchored by Atlanta University, Clark College, Morehouse College, Spelman College, and Morris Brown College. These schools trained ministers, teachers, and professionals, emphasizing race pride, discipline, and a clear understanding of racism. Even underfunded Black public schools were staffed by educators who believed they were, quite literally, training the race. It was into this world that Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15, 1929, 3 years after Carter G. Woodson launched Negro History Week. Woodson, a historian and educator, was the second African American to earn a Ph.D. from Harvard University after W.E.B. Du Bois. The son of formerly enslaved parents, Woodson believed historical erasure carried lasting psychological and civic consequences. Those who have no record of what their forebears have accomplished lose the inspiration which comes from the teaching of biography and history, Woodson wrote in 1933 in his book, The Miseducation of the Negro. Woodson's project was an attempt to document Black achievement and correct a national narrative that had ignored it. The observance was not created simply to remember the past, but to insist that Black excellence, intellect, and contributions were understood as foundational to the American story. He said, "We need to set a week aside so that Black families could spend time teaching Black children about who they are and where they come from," Whitehead said. "Our lives didn't start and end with American slavery. We're more than just a footnote in the American historical narrative." When Woodson introduced Negro History Week, Jim Crow was entrenched after the collapse of Reconstruction. Woodson selected the week that included the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, dates already recognized in black communities and symbolically tied, in his view, to African-American freedom and citizenship. Whitehead pointed to black soldiers in the Revolutionary War and the political gains of Reconstruction, including the election of more than 600 black men to public office after the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870, which gave black men the right to vote. There was an amazing contribution to American history, she said. And that's what he wanted us to teach about, because there was a sense that all we had done was slavery. For decades, Negro History Week was embraced by educators and civic groups. Taking on new urgency during the Civil Rights Movement, the observance grew organically, first expanding from Negro History Week into Black History Month through the work of educators and civic groups. It received formal recognition in 1976 when President Gerald Ford, during the nation's bicentennial, issued a White House proclamation calling on Americans to recognize the contributions of black Americans in the nation's history. Whitehead said that sequence is often misunderstood. It was something that was selected and chosen by us, she said. The proclamation came later. In that sense, King was born into a city already practicing the values Whitson was trying to teach the nation: self-determination, institutional strength, and moral clarity, even as it lived under the constraints of segregation. As the nation marks a century since the first formal celebration of black history in 1926, Whitehead said the anniversary lands in a moment of renewed backlash, as political leaders move to roll back diversity initiatives and narrow how black history can be taught, remembered, and debated. There is no American history without black people, Whitehead said. That American history, that narrative, that quilt includes our contributions. In the span of 100 years of black history commemoration, Atlanta would be tested repeatedly. Its black communities would confront barriers, change systems, and at critical moments, redefine the city's direction. That arc can be traced through five consequential years when Atlanta's black history shifted course and left lasting marks on the city and the nation. After 1929, the year of King's birth, those turning points came in 1961, 1968, 1974, 1994, and 2020, showing how black Atlanta moved from possibility to power, from institution building to protest, and from survival to transformation. The first of those moments came more than three decades later, when the fight over education forced Atlanta and Georgia to confront who its promise was meant to serve. The next part of the story is titled, 1961, School Doors Open, Narrowly. This is a white man's college, and you are perfectly powerless to help yourselves. Patrick Hughes Mell, the chancellor of the University of Georgia from 1878 until 1888, said those words shortly after the Civil War when a group of black Georgians asked that their sons be admitted to the state's flagship institution. For decades, Mell's declaration effectively stood as policy. Nearly a century later, that barrier finally broke through pressure and litigation, not enlightenment. In 1961, under a federal court order, the University of Georgia admitted Hamilton Holmes and Charlene Hunter, both graduates of Atlanta high schools, making them the first black students in the institution's history. Both students had applied to the University of Georgia as freshmen in 1959 and were rejected. Hunter was told there was no room in the women's dormitories. Holmes was informed that his application was incomplete, despite having completed an in-person interview. They sued. The case landed before U.S. District Judge William Boodle, who, in the ruling on January 6, 1961, dismantled the university's explanation for rejecting the students. The University of Georgia did have dormitory vacancies and had admitted white women after rejecting Hunter. Holmes' interview, Boodle wrote, was conducted with the purpose of finding a basis of rejecting him. Although there is no written policy or rule excluding Negroes, including plaintiffs from admission to the university on account of their race, Boodle concluded, there is a tacit policy to that effect. Athens erupted after the ruling. White students gathered at the arch, sang Dixie, and shouted racial slurs. On January 9th, Holmes and Hunter registered for classes. Their first days on campus were marked by isolation and hostility. The violence peaked on the evening of January 11th, when a crowd gathered outside Hunter's dormitory, throwing bricks and bottles and setting fires. Holmes and Hunter were suspended for their own protection and escorted out of Athens by the Georgia State Patrol. What followed surprised many. More than 400 University of Georgia faculty members condemned the riot and called for reinstatement, while Boodle struck down a punitive state law and ordered Holmes and Hunter back to campus days later. As Holmes and Hunter endured violence and scrutiny in Athens, other institutions across Georgia were watching closely. In September 1961, 8 months after the University of Georgia's integration, Georgia Tech quietly enrolled its first black students. Emory followed. Georgia State integrated in 1962. That same summer, Atlanta Public Schools admitted 9 black students to 4 previously all-white high schools. President John F. Kennedy praised the city and state for what he called a responsible, law-abiding process. Holmes and Hunter graduated from the University of Georgia just over 2 years later. While Atlanta had built the Atlanta University Center, where black students had excelled since the 1860s, entry into the state's flagship schools meant access to credentials, networks, and authority. Holmes went on to become the first black graduate of Emory University's medical school and later served on the University of Georgia's Board of Trustees. Hunter Gault built a distinguished career in journalism, working at such outlets as the New York Times and CNN, and in 1988 became the first black person to deliver the University of Georgia's undergraduate commencement address. Atlanta's later political and professional dominance, its lawyers, engineers, administrators, and elected officials, cannot be understood without this quiet, dangerous year. What no one in Athens could have known then was how quickly the meaning of black presence at the University of Georgia would be recast. On March 3, 1962, just 14 months after Holmes and Hunter first tried to walk onto campus, Herschel Jr. Walker, whose legacy would later come to complicate and, in some ways, eclipse the university's long resistance to integration, was born. The next part of the article is titled, 1968, Grief and Reckoning. In the years after 1961, Atlanta perfected the choreography of orderly change. White and black leaders spoke the language of moderation as progress was measured and carefully displayed. Yet the moral urgency of the movement, embodied by Martin Luther King Jr., could not be managed so easily. King was Atlanta's favorite son, educated at Morehouse College, and a Nobel Peace Prize winner by 35. He had become one of the most recognizable black Americans in the world, carrying Atlanta with him onto the national stage. His authority was moral as much as political, and his presence allowed the city to reimagine itself as both progressive and controlled. That illusion collapsed on April 4, 1968, when King was assassinated in Memphis, forcing Atlanta and the nation to confront loss, rage, and the unfinished work of freedom. By the morning of April 9, the day of King's funeral, Atlanta had already stopped moving. Before dawn, mourners climbed trees along Auburn Avenue, while others climbed rooftops. By mid-morning, tens of thousands, men in dark suits and hats, women in Sunday dresses and gloves, pressed toward Ebenezer Baptist Church, filling the streets to see the hearse, to stand in the same air and to bear witness. Outside Ebenezer, loudspeakers carried hymns and eulogies to the crowd. Inside, dignitaries gathered quietly. 2 mules were brought forward to pull the wagon carrying King's African mahogany casket. This would not be a motorcade. It would move at a deliberate pace. The procession stretched 4.3 miles, winding from Auburn Avenue through downtown and the Georgia Capitol toward Morehouse College. At the Capitol, armed state troopers stood watch under orders of Governor Lester Maddox, who refused to close the building or lower the flag. As marchers passed the rifles, church bells rang. Someone began to sing. Soon, Thousands joined in. We shall overcome. By the time the procession reached Morehouse, the crowd had swelled toward 200,000. King's journey stitched together black neighborhoods, political power, and moral reckoning in a single line. The city had prepared for chaos, but remained quiet. Elsewhere, the nation exploded as more than 100 cities burned after King's assassination, followed by the killing of Robert F. Kennedy and televised violence at the Democratic Convention in Chicago as faith in reform collapsed. Atlanta did not burn, but it was changed. King's death saw the movement's energy begin to turn inward, toward governance, economics, and control of institutions. Grief sharpened ambition. In the months after King's death, Atlanta's young black leaders began to consider how the movement could be carried forward. One was a 30-year-old graduate of King's alma mater, Morehouse, who, just days after his daughter was born, quit his job at an Atlanta law firm and borrowed $2,500 to run for the U.S. Senate against Herman Talmadge, a segregationist whose family represented the last gasp of plantation politics. He won less than one-third of the statewide vote in the underfunded campaign, but easily carried Atlanta. In a city still reeling from King's assassination, it was a signal that something had shifted. Maynard Holbrook Jackson had arrived. The next part of the article is titled, 1973 to 1974, Power Takes Hold. On the night of April 4, 1974, when Hank Aaron launched his record-breaking 715th home run, one of the loudest cheers came from a seat a few rows behind the Braves' dugout, Mayor Maynard Jackson. The moment linked two men reshaping Atlanta in different arenas but carrying the same historical weight. Aaron affirming black excellence at the pinnacle of America's game, and Jackson, newly elected, as the city's first black mayor, shifting power from symbolism to governance and ushering in decades of black political leadership. Together, their milestones marked 1974 as a year when black achievement in Atlanta moved from endurance to dominance. But the convergence began months earlier. On September 29, 1973, Aaron hit a three-run home run, his 40th and final homer of the season, finishing the year at 713, one short of Babe Ruth's record. Just 3 days later, Jackson advanced to a runoff against incumbent Mayor Sam Massel. On October 16, 1973, he won decisively, capturing more than 60% of the vote in a political upset that signaled the unraveling of Atlanta's old order. With that victory, black Atlantans gained control of City Hall for the first time, not only the mayor's office, but also the city council and the Board of Education. At the federal level, Atlanta was represented in Congress by Andrew Young, a former aide to Martin Luther King Jr., underscoring how moral leadership was being translated into institutional power. The symbolism was undeniable, but the structural shift was even more profound. Jackson inherited a city still divided by neighborhood, wealth, and access, that proudly marketed itself as too busy to hate, while leaving contracts and capital overwhelmingly in white hands. His administration made power tangible, turning minority participation requirements tied to the expansion of Hartsfield Airport into policy and directing wealth into black hands. Governance now enforced what previous protests had demanded. Then came April. The 1974 baseball season opened in Cincinnati on April 4th, the sixth anniversary of King's assassination. Aaron asked the Reds to observe a moment of silence before the game. The request was denied. Aaron hit a two-run home run in the first inning, tying Ruth at 714. 4 days later, back in Atlanta, history arrived on schedule. As Aaron circled the bases after number 715, the crowd roared. Among them sat Jackson, watching a different kind of barrier fall. One man represented black political power newly rooted in governance. The other embodied black excellence that had endured scrutiny and death threats. If 1973 transferred power, 1974 tested it. By the end of that year, Jackson moved to institutionalize Atlanta's cultural future, creating the Bureau of Cultural Affairs to cultivate and sustain artistic expression. Power, he said, was also cultural. But as Jackson was building a legacy in Atlanta, Aaron was closing his. After the 1974 season, the Braves traded him to Milwaukee, ending his tenure in Atlanta, where he had made history. On May 27, 1975, now playing out the final stretch of his career as a left fielder and designator hitter for the Brewers, Aaron went 1-for-3 with a pair of RBIs. A few hours later, in Atlanta, Andre Lauren Benjamin was born. The next part of the article is titled, 1994, Atlanta Finds Its Voice. On April 26, 1994, Atlanta announced itself to the rest of the country, not through politics or protest, but through music. That Tuesday morning, Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music, the debut album from two young Atlanta rappers, Andre 3000 and Big Boy, collectively known as Outkast, arrived. For years, Atlanta had been defined by black leadership moving from the pulpit to City Hall, with Martin Luther King Jr. shaping the city's moral center and black mayors governing its institutions. What Atlanta had not yet done was declare itself culturally, on its own terms. Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music changed that. The album was a revelation, emerging from a city shaped not by the aftermath of the civil rights movement and the gains and limits of a generation that came after the marches ended. Before 1994, Atlanta's musical identity was diffuse. The city had produced R&B stars, gospel giants, and funk legacies, but hip-hop remained peripheral, often filtered through coastal expectations. New York set the lyrical standard. Los Angeles supplied the attitude. Despite the success of artists and producers like Arrested Development, Dallas Austin, and Jermaine Dupri, Southern artists were still treated as regional curiosities, their accents dismissed, their stories flattened. That changed one Tuesday morning with the release of Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music. Built on live bass lines, church-inflected harmonies, and a slow southern pacing, the album sounded conversational, humid, and patient. It spoke in the unapologetic language of black Atlanta neighborhoods, the projects, Marta, Survival, and Cadillacs. In one disparaging line, it even name-dropped Maynard Jackson, showing that there could be tension between politics and culture. Just 4 months after Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music's release, promoter and cultural archivist Jason Orr launched the first Funk Jazz Cafe, a genre-collapsing gathering where hip-hop, spoken word, jazz, and soul became a shared language. Funk Jazz, where everyone from Jill Scott and Erykah Badu to Dougie Fresh could appear unannounced, became an incubator for Atlanta's creative ecosystem, mirroring what the city itself was becoming, layered, experimental, and self-defined. A year later, Andre 3000 and Big Boy traveled to New York to accept the Best New Rap Group Award at the 1995 Source Awards and were met with boos. Andre stepped forward, took the microphone, met the boos, and ended the argument in six words. The South got something to say. It was a line about music, but it was also about authorship. Atlanta was no longer begging to be recognized. Outkast would go on to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, becoming one of the most influential rap groups in history, while the city produced a generation of artists, from Goody Mob to Future, who made Atlanta impossible to ignore. The declaration reached beyond hip-hop, reshaping how the city saw itself and how the country saw Atlanta as a cultural engine shaping sound, style, politics, and imagination. On May 14, 1994, weeks after Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music was released, Keisha Lance Bottoms, an Atlanta native and the daughter of a former R&B singer, Major Lance, graduated from Georgia State University's College of Law. The final part of this article is titled, 2020, The Atlanta Way Breaks. Keisha Lance Bottoms was furious. On the evening of May 29, 2020, she stood at a podium at the Atlanta Police Department alongside Police Chief Erica Shields and hip-hop stars T.I. and Killer Mike, and delivered a blunt message to thousands of protesters. If you care about this city, then go home. Outside, Atlanta was in bedlam. Sparked by the murder of George Floyd under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, what began as a peaceful protest had devolved into destruction. Marchers ransacked parts of the city, smashing windows, looting stores, and setting police cars on fire. "This is not a protest," Bottoms said. "This is not in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. This is chaos. A protest has purpose. When Dr. King was assassinated, we didn't do this to our city. You are disgracing our city. You are disgracing the life of George Floyd and every other person who has been killed in this country." As the city burned, it was clear that Atlanta had lost its way. For decades, the city had prided itself on following the Atlanta way. Andrew Young had championed the term, built on the idea that even the city's hardest moments could be navigated through restraint, coalition, and patience. That approach helped explain why Atlanta never became Birmingham or Little Rock during the Civil Rights era, and how the Southern city went on to build the world's busiest airport and host the 1996 Olympics. But in 2020, that idea finally cracked. At the center of the storm stood Bottoms, Atlanta's 60th mayor and its second woman to hold the office, facing a city unraveling on multiple fronts. The year opened in mourning. Within months of one another, Atlanta lost three pillars of the Civil Rights era and Presidential Medal of Freedom winners, Joseph Lowery, John Lewis, and C.T. Vivian, who had marched and bled the city into a symbol of black political progress. Their deaths closed a chapter of moral authority. The city was already grieving when the world shut down. COVID-19 arrived quietly, then relentlessly. Churches closed, schools emptied, streets thinned. The virus tore through black communities strained by health inequities and economic vulnerability. More than 42,400 Georgians died, with Atlanta bearing a disproportionate share. Weeks after the George Floyd protests, the fracture deepened. In June, Rayshard Brooks was shot and killed by a police officer outside of Wendy's in southwest Atlanta. Protests returned to the streets. The restaurant burned. The city's moral center shifted again because Atlanta could no longer claim distance from the violence it condemned. By the year's end, 2020 had stripped Atlanta of its illusion that progress was manageable without reckoning. What remained was grief, anger, and a generation with little patience for process. The old guard was gone, and the systems they built were under siege. If 1968 shattered Atlanta's innocence and 1973 restructured its power, 2020 forced the city to confront itself without certainty that the old ways still worked. The Atlanta way did not survive 2020 intact. On May 6, 2021, almost a year after the protest, Keisha Lance Bottoms announced she would not seek re-election as mayor. As of today, Bottoms is widely viewed as a leading Democratic contender for governor of Georgia. That was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper article titled, "Black History at 100, 5 Years That Changed Atlanta, Tracing the Dynamics of Race, Power, and Culture Through the Events That Fundamentally Reshaped Our City." This was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 1st, 2026. My next article is titled, "Atlanta Fortune 500 Firm Faces Discrimination Investigation." This was written by Mirtha Dornestorg and published February 15, 2026 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's AJC.com website. Genuine Parts Company, the Atlanta-based Fortune 500 parent of Napa Auto Parts, is under investigation for allegations it violated federal law by discriminating against black job applicants, according to new court filings. The investigation, started under the Biden administration and continuing under the Trump administration, dates to 2024. Details on the case are scant, and its existence only came to light late last week when the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed an action in Texas district courts to enforce a subpoena in the case. The alleged discriminatory practices include failures to recruit and hire black candidates on the basis of their race, according to the charge. It does not detail specific instances of discrimination behind the allegations. The charge was filed about a month after publication of a study on employment practices by U.S. companies that spurred a prominent civil rights group to write a letter urging an EEOC investigation into Genuine Parts and another company. Title VII's prohibition on race-based employment discrimination is colorblind, and its protections apply equally to all workers. EEOC Chair Andrea Lucas said in a news release announcing the subpoena enforcement action. The commission will continue to use every tool Congress has provided to enforce the law, and when employers refuse to comply, the EEOC will not hesitate to use its full legal authority. Genuine Parts and its lawyers did not respond to multiple requests by phone and email for comment by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. That was the article titled, Atlanta Fortune 500 Firm Faces Discrimination Investigation. This was written by Mirtha Donestorg and published February 15, 2026 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's AJC.com website. My next reading on today's African American Hour is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's 2026 Black History Month series of stories. It's titled, 1906 Atlanta Race Massacre Sparked a Reckoning Within. After the days of terror ended, Walter White decided to identify only as a black man. This was written by Nedra Roan and published February 6, 2026. My skin is white. My eyes are blue. My hair is blonde, writes Walter White in the opening lines of his 1948 autobiography. These facts are preceded by White's most important declaration, I am a Negro. For White, who would later gain fame as the executive secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, blackness was a choice. At the time, an estimated 12,000 white-skinned black people each year disappeared across the color line in search of a better life. Passing allowed white-appearing black people to avail themselves of all the privileges that society afforded to white skin. Though Americans at the time believed race was determined by the one-drop rule, a system of racial classification that defined any person with a single black ancestor as black, it hadn't always been that way. Early on, different colonies and states had different ways of defining who was black, said George Hutchinson, professor of American culture at Cornell University. Passing took many forms, he said. Some white-appearing black people held on to family ties while taking advantage of jobs or other perks of whiteness. Others married white spouses and moved to white neighborhoods but still maintained family contact. And still others, whose stories have been dramatically depicted in popular culture, were black people whose move into whiteness meant severing connections to birth families, friends, and neighborhoods. Black literature is full of stories about how the choice to pass as white is morally indefensible, and the people who end up doing it are always sorry, Hutchinson said. There was always somewhat of a moral judgment against it, particularly when people were cutting off their families. This was considered an ethical problem. In White's case, he often found himself explaining to white people why he would choose to be black when he could easily pass for white. They think it must be some mistake, White said. But one experience in September 1906 erased any inclination he may have had to pass himself off as a white man. White was only 13 years old when he witnessed the 1906 Atlanta race massacre, when thousands of white Atlantans roamed the streets terrorizing black people. More than 25 black people died. The Atlanta riot naturally stands out in my memory as a shocking awakening to the cruelty of which men driven by prejudice, ignorance, and hatred can be guilty, he said. After the 4 days of terror ended, White was sure of one thing. He desired to identify only as a black man. I was glad my mind and spirit were part of the races that had not fully awakened, he said, and who therefore had still before them the opportunity to write a record of virtue as a memorandum to Armageddon. White was born in Atlanta in 1893. He lived in an 8-room, 2-story house on Houston Street, now John Wesley Dobbs Avenue, just 3 blocks from the Candler Building, the city's first skyscraper. He recalled the Saturday in September 1906 when an unseasonable warmth settled over an eerily quiet Atlanta. Headlines in the daily papers, including the Atlanta Constitution, reported alleged rapes and crimes committed by black people, but the stories made little impression on White. What he didn't know was the effect those stories were having on white residents. His father, a mail carrier, was preparing for his usual 3 to 11 p.m. route. White usually accompanied him until 7 p.m., driving the car of his father, making stops. But on this Saturday, his father told him to stay home. White appealed to his mother, who allowed him to go if he promised to return before dark. He was too young to grasp that the city, fueled by a bitter political campaign, had become a tinderbox of racial animus. As they approached the corner of Peachtree and Houston Streets, White heard a roar and watched as the local bootblack from a nearby barbershop was beaten to death by a white mob. They raced down Pryor Street in the mail cart, his father slowing only to grab an elderly black hotel cook from the clutches of the white man pursuing her. The only thing that kept White and his father from being targeted was their skin color and the government vehicle in which they rode. By Sunday, black residents in defense mode prepared for a sleepless night. Some of them took up arms to fend off the mob that was planning a midnight rampage in their neighborhood. White said he and his father secured guns, and father told son, "Don't shoot until the first man puts his foot on the lawn, and then don't you miss." As men carrying torches approached the home, 13-year-old White grabbed his firearm and swallowed his fear. How would it feel to kill a man, he wondered. In that moment, he said, he knew he could never identify as a person so filled with hate, even if it meant being one of the hated. A volley of shots from down the street stopped the advancing mob, and White and his father were safe, but the moment changed the trajectory of his life. Just a few years earlier, White had crossed the color line when he was employed by Atlanta's luxurious Piedmont Hotel. Working as a page boy, he realized he was the only black employee assigned to those duties. The interviewer had never asked his race. The pay was the best he had received, but when his boss offered to pay more and a higher rank the following summer, White confessed his secret and was out of a job. These are the moments that shaped White into the man who was later dubbed Mr. NAACP for leading the civil rights organization from the 1930s to the 1950s. In 1916, White and Harry Proctor, both parishioners at First Congregational Church, secured a charter to establish the Atlanta chapter of the NAACP. Though White prided himself on his racial identity, early members of the Atlanta National Association for the Advancement of Colored People were almost exclusively from the black middle class or black elite. The first battle of the Atlanta NAACP was to prevent the Atlanta School Board from eliminating 7th grade at black schools in order to fund a new junior high school for white students. Their efforts were a success. A year later, White left Atlanta to join the national chapter of the organization. His profile grew from his daring undertakings, using his appearance as a white man to infiltrate white spaces and file reports on lynching and racial terror groups. White also wrote often about his decision to identify as black instead of choosing to pass as white, and he inspired both praise and revulsion from fellow Americans. In the years before his death in 1955, he came to settle with the discord within the recognition that people are mostly the same. White is black, and black is white. Each casts a shadow, he said, and all shadows are dark. That was the article titled, 1906 Atlanta Race Massacre Sparked a Reckoning Within. After the days of terror ended, Walter White desired to identify only as a black man. This was written by Netra Roan, and published February 6, 2026, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's AJC.com website. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper is publishing one story every day during the month of February for Black History Month. This story is from Sunday, February 8, 2026, and is titled, Former Center for Disease Control Employee, Our DEI Work Saved Lives. From Tuskegee to COVID, Benita Harris spent decades fighting healthcare disparity. This was written by Ariel Hart and Tamar Hallerman. Benita Harris was one of the few young Black workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the 1990s when history called. President Bill Clinton needed help. Clinton wanted to officially apologize for the Tuskegee study, an infamous federal project that withheld medical treatment from Black men in Alabama with syphilis for 40 years, beginning in 1932. Harris's mission in life was to break down social barriers in healthcare, and she knew this public gesture would help. Her research locating the study's survivors and descendants landed them in a White House ceremony, where Americans saw them on national news accepting the president's tears, the nation's recognition, and its promise to do better. Now, Harris and her line of work are living through history again. For 34 years, Harris worked at the CDC, bridging the gaps in public health for marginalized groups like gay people and racial groups. But when the current presidential administration took office, anything hinting of diversity, equity, or inclusion was deemed as toxic overreach. Across the country, funding grants were revoked, departments were eliminated, and workers lost their jobs, including at the CDC. Harris's Office of Minority Health and Health Equity was officially disbanded April 1st, and employees were told to turn in their equipment. She was forced into early retirement, her benefits threatened. On a personal level, she was traumatized by a chaotic personnel process and public harassment. Between those dramatic bookends to her career, Harris witnessed tremendous progress. During the COVID-19 pandemic, she helped show CDC leaders their default methods of encouraging vaccination needed to change. And she helped initiate a project that persuaded Black people to overcome their distrust of public health and get vaccinated, thereby saving lives. For Harris, who suddenly finds herself on the other side of her career, and a pivotal era in the nation's public health history, that project defines her legacy. We made a difference and the world was able to get up and get back out, she said. We were able to live once again. The next part of the article is titled, Historical Precedent for Distrust. There is a long history of racial discrimination in U.S. medicine that has led to a distrust of public health initiatives among Black populations. Data shows the health system's mistaken assumptions about race still contribute to disparity in healthcare today. Studies have shown that Black patients who need pain medication, like kids in the emergency room for appendicitis, don't get it as often as white patients in similar situations. A 2016 study of 222 medical students found that more than a quarter of them believe Black skin is thicker than white, and mistaken beliefs like that correlated with a shortening of pain medication for Black patients in a theoretical scenario. But if any one event is credited for destroying African Americans' distrust in the government health system, it is what the CDC calls the untreated syphilis study of Tuskegee. It's a shocking story. From 1932 to 1972, a U.S. Public Health Service study withheld diagnosis and treatment of 400 Black men infected with syphilis so scientists could track the progression of the disease. Beginning in the 1960s, whistleblower Ted Buxton, a Public Health Service employee, filed multiple internal complaints about the study. A CDC investigation was conducted, but the study continued until Buxton went to the Associated Press and the news exploded nationwide. A congressional hearing was held. The study was shut down and new rules were adopted to protect study subjects. But medical professionals, tests, and algorithms continue to make race-based mistakes. It goes both ways. Scientific studies find, from using race as a factor when it isn't, to assuming race isn't a factor when it is. For example, medical products have been approved that weren't adequately tested on black subjects, for whom they might function differently. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the fingertip devices that measured oxygenated blood became invaluable in treating patients. But the devices don't read black skin as well as white skin, a known flaw since 2007. According to a 2024 report, Johns Hopkins University said, these findings were largely ignored and even denied by both manufacturers and regulators until racial reckonings during COVID-19 prompted regulators to do better. In another example, until recently, thousands of black transplant candidates were artificially pushed down the waiting list for kidneys. The formula used to determine who needed a new kidney most mistakenly assumed black patients weren't as sick as white patients because of assumptions about why some black people have higher levels of creatinine in their systems. Only during the pandemic was the formula adjusted. In 2024, 14,000 black patients were advanced on the transplant list. The next part of the article is titled, Saving Lives Through Partnerships. These are the kinds of medical mistakes Harris has spent a lifetime trying to fix. I always wanted to know why we were sicker, despite coming from what people deemed middle class, said Harris, a native of South Carolina. Her mother died in childbirth, and she was raised by her paternal grandmother, who had a huge goiter on her neck that could have been fixed with iodized salt. As soon as Harris could get her license, she was driving her family members to doctor appointments. In high school, she enrolled in a program that gave students the opportunity to work with hospital and health professionals. Then it was the 1980s, and she noticed significant numbers of young men coming home to die from a disease that later became known as AIDS. She wanted to make sure they were treated with understanding. She got her college and advanced degree in public health at the University of South Carolina and went to work where she felt she could make the most impact connecting marginalized communities to health services, the government. Within a few years, she was employed by the CDC. When the pandemic struck in 2020, Harris worked in the Office of Minority Health and Health Equity and was asked to help the emergency response team. We asked for her specifically, said Ram Kopaka, who was Associate Director for Adult and Influenza Immunization. 3 months into the pandemic, racial disparities among survivors became apparent. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot announced that although black residents made up about 30% of the city, they were making up about 70% of the COVID-19 deaths. In Georgia, advocates realized that in the majority of cases, race data wasn't being collected. Harris and her colleagues knew from experience that one of the most impactful ways to prevent sickness and death in marginalized communities was to build trust and foster a receptive attitude toward CDC's evolving health directives. Whatever new thing it is, whatever change, it's always to be expected in an environment without universal health care that we're always going to have a very specific disparity, mainly focused on black and brown people and people in rural America, said Dimitri Daskalakis, former director of the National Center of Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the CDC. It's always the same. Harris and Kopaka knew the CDC wasn't connecting with black audiences and that the stakes would be even higher when vaccines became available. Kopaka oversaw a listening session for CDC members and community leaders who delivered brutally honest feedback. That session led to an unprecedented adult immunization initiative in CDC's history. Called Partnering in Vaccine Equity, it distributed more than $260 million in grants to hundreds of partner organizations that spread the word or hosted vaccination clinics and cascaded those grants down to smaller organizations. The effort sent more than 200,000 trusted messengers into the communities, holding information sessions, posting on social media, and distributing educational materials. Harris's skills for reaching out to the community were invaluable. Jackie Burton, leads the Conference of National Black Churches, a group of more than 30,000 congregations claiming around 20 million worshipers. When Harris first started calling from the CDC in late 2020 to lay the groundwork for COPACA, Burton ignored the voicemails. "I didn't know her," Burton explained. Harris kept calling, and her message finally landed. She wasn't just asking for help. CDC wanted to partner on a funded grant that would pay churches and their members for their work. "The CDC saved countless lives with this vaccine program," Burton said. The concept behind the program was based on the knowledge that the public needed to hear from trusted partners in their own communities. That could be a nurse, or a barber, or a pastor. It wasn't Dr. Anthony Fauci, former chief medical advisor to the president. Educational materials were branded by the local organizations or partners. "They chose not to use the CDC logo," Harris said. "At that time, we were not trusted agencies." Bishop J. Drew Sherrod has never met Harris, but over those years, he became a powerful advocate. "Members were very skeptical," Sherrod said, "of the news coming out of the government and of the vaccine. With the education and resources from the CDC, Sherrod's own church not only spread information about the disease and the vaccine, but also held vaccination clinics where groceries were offered. Cars lined up around the block. Minds changed. What Harris did was so important to get with the black church," Sherrod said. "In his recollection, no one in my congregation, and I pastor a pretty large congregation, died of COVID." COPACA credits Harris with driving home the impact of this approach. Daskalakis confirmed that Harris kept putting us in the right rooms with the right people to hear what the issues were, so that we could try to address them as best we could. In 2021, the CDC's partner organizations administered 1.7 million COVID and flu vaccinations. Along with other organizations working toward the same goal, their efforts, combined with the growing distrust of the vaccine among white populations, contributed to a marked narrowing of the national vaccination gap between black and white adults. In May 2021, 14% more whites than blacks had been vaccinated. By July 2022, the gap was 5%, according to the health research organization KFF. The final section of the article is titled, "Eliminating DEI Has Ripple Effect." The federal government had finally enacted something that closed the gap in adult vaccination disparities. The investment didn't last. Even before President Joe Biden's administration left office, the Partnering for Vaccine Equity program was on the rocks. "Heartbreaking doesn't even begin to summarize how disheartening it is," said Amy Feeblecorn, a veteran vaccination worker for the CDC who fought the pandemic as team lead for partnerships. "To see the momentum we were building and the trust that we were forming with partners who were new to public health, partners who were new to vaccination, and to hear some of the stories come out of these efforts about bridges being crossed and new understanding about people getting vaccinated who would not even have considered it prior, and to know that all of this work was being undone as the funding dried up, it's hard to watch," she said. Then came the Trump administration. First, our office was told to take equity out of the name, so they became the partnership branch. Then, last April, the entire branch was sent home on administrative leave. Several branches in that center that did what the administration thought was equity or DEI work were demolished, erased, Harris said. Like many other CDC employees let go by Trump advisor Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, Harris's separation was chaotic. There was no expression of gratitude for her service. After 34 years on the job, she was told she would get no retirement, no pension, no health insurance. When she fought back, there was often no human resources department to fight with, as most of those employees had been laid off. With legal help, she secured her retirement benefits, but they continued to glitch. About a week after she was put on administrative leave, Harris's dog started barking like crazy one day. She looked on her porch and saw 50 pizzas had been delivered. A colleague called and said Harris had been added to a DEI watch list compiled by a pro-Trump group. And she was among others who had been harassed with massive pizza deliveries. It was a way for malicious hackers to indicate they knew where people lived. Per protocol, she contacted the CDC Office of Safety and Security. "I'm afraid for my life, afraid to get out of the house," she remembers telling them. "I can't go to my doctor's appointment. What can you do?" She says she never heard back. As a target of the Department of Government Efficiency, she felt crumbling solidarity among colleagues as some CDC workers were afraid to be in contact with her. "I was treated like I had the plague," she said. Harris was terrified. She had her son's dog trained as an attack dog. She did something she never thought she'd do. She bought a gun. "Why would someone put me, someone who's so low down at CDC, on the front page of a DEI watch list?" Harris wondered. When a gunman shot up the CDC building last August, a friend sent her a photo of the window where she used to sit. A glinting bullet hole was visible at head level. "That was trauma," she said. Harris doesn't know what to make of the CDC's future. She doesn't want it to fail. "If it can be a force to make the world a better place, I'm all for that." When queried about an Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter about the Tuskegee study during an interview about the future of DEI, the CDC's new policy guru, Principal Deputy Director Ralph Abraham, praised the Tuskegee Airmen, the famous World War II hero pilots. He assured a confused reporter he knew it was a different group of people, but it was a good memory prompted by the word Tuskegee. "It was wrong. We knew that," Abraham said. "But you know, that was way past and it was unfortunate. If I could flip a switch and change it, absolutely I would." That was the article titled, "Former Center for Disease Control Employee, Our DEI Work Saved Lives." From Tuskegee to COVID, Benita Harris spent decades fighting healthcare disparity. This was written by Ariel Hart and Tamar Hallerman and published February 8, 2026 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. This article was part of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's 2026 Black History Month series of articles. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.